My name is Dick Anderson. I am alcoholic. And today's is going to be kind of casual. There's a nice flow to it. I'm going to talk about the last half of the 12th step. It says practice these principles in all our affairs. And the trouble with that is, what are the principles? I've seen people that write down 36 things to go along with the 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12. And while that's clever, that's not it. There are only a few principles in life, period. And the biggest one was in the big book, and I didn't get it for a long, long time. It says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. If God has all power, how much power do you have? None. How much do I have? None. Which is, at first, bad news, but it ends up being good news, because when I got to AA, I was resentful towards God, towards everybody I know. It took me my fourth inventory before I finally figured that out, but I was angry at everybody. And the reason was, I thought you had the power to ruin my life. If you don't have any power, you can't. What you think of me is your business. It doesn't ruin me. What you say about me doesn't ruin my life. How you live, if you do something that, if you're angry at me, that doesn't ruin my life. I don't have to wait to see if you like me and I'm in a relationship and see if somebody says something good about me all the time. I'm just free to live the way God wants me to live. But my life was so far from that when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. My defining characteristic was defiance. I was arrested 22 times before I got to AA, and none of those were for intelligent crimes, like, you know, where you make money or, you know, anything that was romantic or anything like that. It was always, nobody's going to tell me what to do. And if you notice, drunks really like Frank Sinatra singing, "I Did It My Way." And they do. They get emotional, start crying. And I saw Sinatra out at Lake Tahoe many years ago, and, you know, people were generally crying. But they're also crying after about their fifth or sixth Manhattan. And so, you know, that's, I'm going to do it my way. And I'm proud of the way I do it. And all of that is just the opposite of what we're being asked to do. And we've got 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12 concepts. Now, honestly, the concepts you don't normally hear about unless you're going to the General Service Conference in New York. I was your delegate for Area 16, which is the Georgia area, about 10 or 11 years ago. And I got to go there, and we run the meetings by those concepts. And about six of them have nothing to do with anything that we do, and there's no mystery of life hidden in them or anything, but there are another six that have spiritual meanings. They say that when you give a job to somebody and give them a title, you also give them the authority. That means if you're in charge of going to get the coffee, then I can't gripe about what kind of coffee you get if you have the responsibility for that. Unless we had a group conscious meeting and then we decided we'd like to get a certain kind of coffee. And I have made my living, I've been in the military, and after that it was always writing and producing or directing. And when you're producing and directing, you're telling people what to do. And I would send people out, and I would want them to get a certain type of wardrobe or a certain thing for the set, whatever. And if they didn't do exactly what I would have done, I'd get angry. And I'd have a short fuse, and I'd say, that's not what I wanted. And they did the best they could with what they had. I now believe, because of the change that's happened to me, is seeing how God's principles work in all of my affairs, that God puts each one of us together because each of us has a different talent, each of us has a different viewpoint, and that's called collaboration. So that if I trust God, that means that I trust that the person that's assigned to that project, to that part of it, who's doing that job, has also been picked by God. So either I trust God or I don't trust God. And trusting God is at the basis of everything we do. I was fortunate enough to, when I got sober, I went into DTs. I've been sober for 38 years next month. And I went into DTs for about 5-6 days. And when I came out of them, there was a guy who was just coming back in that I'd seen in there before, and he'd gone out and had a slip. And I started crying, and I just said, I'm not going to do this. And when I got here, I had a pair of yellow brownish pants, which were practical. I thought they looked like country club pants, but I was had lost control of some things, and so it was a good color for me. And then I had a blue polo shirt, and I had some loafers that are kind of like these, except they were called Weejuns, and with holes in the bottom. And I had a 45 that I had left over from Vietnam. I had two tours in Vietnam because I was very paranoid. So my thought was, I started crying, and I said, I'm going to go back out. And they said, wait a minute, and they played a tape. And it was a tape of a man who started talking, and he was in the Marine Corps. He had gone to Yale. Now, I didn't go to Yale or Princeton or Art, but I qualified when I was in the ninth grade. I made good enough grades on my SAT to go to any of those schools. They just wouldn't accept somebody with my arrest record. So, but I identified, and it was this talk that Sandy gave called Drop the Rock, where he was talking about this weight that was on our back, and he just let go of it. And the way, I don't know anybody that was better with word pictures when he was speaking than Sandy Beach. And Sandy died last December, and I was fortunate enough to be one of the people that eulogized him at a service down in Tampa. And there had to be 200 or 300 people that you'd see speaking at conferences all over the United States in the audience. There were about 1,500 people there. But Sandy was, of the people who spoke anyway, he was the best example we had of AA, because he was constantly talking about being wrong, constantly learning, and then sharing with us what he had learned. And he wrote a book, the only book he ever wrote, and it was, it's called Dear Friend, Letters for Your Spiritual Journey. And if you come up here, I'll give you the name of the publishing company. He gave this to me, but I don't know. I think you probably have to call the publishing company to get it. But it's a great book, and he has a letter for every week with a little thing you can do on the left to kind of absorb that. But here's what he says: Dear reader, I have prepared these letters to you in the hope that you will use them to partake of spiritual nourishment on a weekly basis. We all have busy schedules, and the demands of family, work, friends, and other commitments swallow up our free time. Perhaps you don't think you can afford the luxury of spending time on your spiritual side. The truth is, you can't afford not to do it. Most of us never realize that a steady starvation of our souls is at the heart of all our difficulties. Instead, we conclude time after time that our problem stems from a lack of money, respect, a good relationship, sex, or a new car. I'm not sure if sex or new car is like a multiple choice or whatever, but this book will help you conduct a very practical and simple experiment on yourself. Each week, you will read and contemplate a new spiritual message. On the following page, you will find a sample worksheet that will give you some ideas about how to go about charting your own weekly plan. I hope that you will direct your energies towards this most vital area of your life. The rewards are great, and you deserve them. Very frankly, it is essential that you observe closely the personal transformation that will start taking place in your life as you follow these simple steps. As you begin to balance your spiritual needs with the other pressing matters in your life, changes will occur. Ultimately, it will be your awareness of these changes and of an accompanying spiritual power flowing in your life that will give you the faith to continue. As you consistently give nourishment to the essence of yourself, your spiritual nature, all other areas of your life will miraculously be made better. And I don't know anybody that practiced that better than Sandy. And Sandy, after hearing his tape, a week later, somebody put me in a station wagon and took me to the intergroup dinner, and the speaker was Chuck Chamberlain. And for those who've been around long enough, Chuck wrote a book. Actually, he didn't write a book, and this didn't come out. He was until after he had died, because he didn't want his name on anything and didn't want to do anything that would be considered egotistical. But he would do a weekend with the men that he sponsored and loved, as Sandy did. And Sandy, it was called the Far Corners, and people came from the Far Corners. There were 54 men met once a year with Sandy for a retreat, and I was fortunate enough to be able to go on that. But this is a new pair of glasses by Chuck C. So I'm going to mention a lot of our literature in AA, and don't take notes, don't write. This is just if you can catch the essence of what we're talking about today, your life's going to get a lot better. But these are books, well, you may not take them to the meeting, But nobody I know who does well in AA doesn't read a lot of books outside of AA. The AA literature is just designed so that when you get a newcomer, there's nothing controversial about it. But as soon as I had a few days, they gave me Sermon on the Mount. This wasn't written yet, another one was called The Power of Positive Thinking. Anyway, there are all kinds of things. I had really gotten down the power of negative thinking. So I could turn any positive situation into a negative because I could always gripe about somebody, so forth. And that's the way I lived when I got here. I mean, I don't know any newcomers that come in here with a light shining out of their head. So, and so then this is one of my favorite brochures. It's a Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was written by a professional writer, and this is how he closes it. He said, "This coming Sunday in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod, and hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, 'Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another?' And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, 'Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them.' Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not only mean the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit, those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. More than 16 years ago, four men, my boss, my physician, my pastor, and the one friend I had left, working singly and together, maneuvered me into AA. Tonight, if they were to ask me, 'Tell us, what did you find?' I would say to them what I now say to you. I can tell you only that I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so." And that's what makes AA work. In all the traditions, all the steps, all the concepts, nowhere in there do you have to understand any kind of religion. There was some religious verbiage in this, but when AA started, it started as a Christian group. It's part of the Oxford group. And for those who, I've got one handout that people can take, and the others you can just look at, but this is what is the Oxford group, and it has a lot of material. If you read through this, you'll see half of where the big book came from, even the same language. And what Bill Wilson did when he and a few other people wrote the big book was this didn't just sprout out of their, you know, they didn't make this up. It wasn't like Faulkner writing a novel. What Wilson did was organize the wisdom that everybody else had. Religious people, all kinds of spiritual people, psychiatrists, doctors. Here's a book that was written 9 years before the big book. It's called The Common Sense of Drinking by a psychiatrist named Richard Peabody. And here's just one page. He has steps where you can recover, but it's not the same kind of steps we have because it was more in terms of psychologically. But six is self-persuasion. This is where you change your mind. A man must make up his mind to do everything in his power to cooperate in such work as there is to be done. Halfway measures are of no avail. That's written 9 years before the big book. So what I learned in studying the big book over the years is that that was given to us. We don't have anything exclusive. It's just the genius of it was that our literature, our steps, our traditions, our concepts are organized in such a way where you can be an idiot and it still works. Because you don't have to understand anything, you just have to do. If you do, then the understanding comes after you're doing. So I'm going to I'll mention a couple of other things. There are a lot of articles that we don't read at meetings, but we should. Michael later is going to be talking about emotional sobriety, and that term came from a Grapevine article that Bill Wilson wrote back in 1953, and got a copy of it up here. There's another book. What's the name of the book with all the Grapevine stories in it? The
Language of the Heart.
Yeah, and here's one. This Matter of Honesty. because this is one of the best I've read. It has nothing to do with me being honest with you. It has to do with self-honesty, because that's the trick here, being honest with myself. And so I have one handout that you can come up later, because I'm talking about, when I talk about these principles, I'm going to be talking about them both in the group and then how they relate to me personally. And what I've learned to do in AA then allowed me to carry the same thing over into the rest of my life. If you come to AA and you live one way and then you go outside, you know, we call people that go to church on Sunday and then live differently the rest of the week hypocrites. But what do we call alcoholics who come to an AA meeting and listen to it and then go out and live differently? AA members. We don't take criticism well. So so the one pamphlet, if you got any question about a group, this is, I think it looks a little bit different now, it's green or something, but this is called the AA group. And it's one of the most unread pieces of literature we have. It answers almost every question about an AA group and how to take an inventory of an AA group. And yes, just like I need an inventory, and the guys I sponsor, we always do an annual inventory. And we may not do it, we do the inventory like the big book says, but we also take a look at like a state of the union. How am I as a husband? How am I as a father? How am I? We list our jobs. We do a budget of the time for our jobs. If you have 20 different jobs and you look down and you had to be, to be a good husband, you have to donate 20 hours a week, you know, probably more than that, but you start listing and you don't have enough time to do all the jobs, you won't succeed at any of them. So we just blindly go into things and do things, and then when something doesn't work out, we think it's not our fault, but we can determine where we put our time and energy. You know, people, I know some people that go to spend too much time in AA. All their time is in AA. And yet they've got a family, they're not doing their duty as a husband, they're not doing their duty at work, they're leaving early so they can go to AA things. That's not getting well. That's just using AA the same way you used other things. People, you can use AA as an escape, just like we use liquor as an escape, or sex as an escape, or buying things as an escape. Anyway, this is terrific, and I put together a one sheet. I brought 30 or 40 of them, and it's called Practicing AA Principles at the Group Level. And it's much akin to a similar outline that we did for Area 16 so that we can conduct our meetings. We live in a different era now, so some of the things I want to talk about, you don't know. But there's a book called Robert's Rules of Order. And the way in which we govern ourselves is that we use Robert's Rules of Order, except the only area in which we differ is where the traditions or concepts lead us to a slight difference. If we make a decision, important decision about our group, where Robert's Rules might allow that to be done with just a plurality, in AA we need to have two-thirds. Because you see what happens in the nation where you get 51% of the vote, and then everybody's fighting back and forth the whole time. If you got two-thirds of the vote to make a decision, then it's pretty well that's what the group wants. So then you don't go back and re-decide it all the time. This, at the time when AA was started, most people knew Robert's Rules of Order because every town meeting that was taking place, our form of government at the lowest level was a town meeting you could go. And what you look for in this, in AA, you're looking for God's will in the group. So that means, unlike a group conscious meeting where somebody brings a bunch of people and they're all real vocal and they say the same thing over and over trying to get their point across because they want to win this argument, if we're practicing the principles of AA, everybody, whether they have one day or 40 years, gets 2 minutes, one time, and there's no cross-talking. So you can voice your experience and then move on. We had my home group, I really thought we should have a meeting where we studied the traditions and the steps, and because step one and tradition one have something to do with each other. If it's an interesting relationship, because one is surrendering the group to God's will and the other is surrendering us to God's will and so forth. So I came up with the idea. I said that we had that kind of meeting when I was new in AA and da-da-da, and everybody went along with it. And I thought it would be on Wednesday night, and the group decided to have it Saturday night. And I'm never in town on Saturday night because we're off going to AA conferences on the weekend. So I've been to that about twice since it started. But that was what the group decided to do. So I pictured it differently, and I wanted to be part of it, but it's working for the people that are going on Saturday night. So this and I'll talk about some of these traditions and concepts later, but this covers how you have a meeting, how you discuss things, how a motion is made, and how you practice the concepts in the group. So I brought enough of these copies, and any group that you belong to, if you will give this to the chair, this is straight out of the book. This is how we're supposed to run a meeting. And it helps a lot where, you know, especially when you have a meeting where there's a lot of discord, this generally eliminates it because nobody gets to speak louder than anybody else. So those are in a yellow envelope up here. So this stuff's mine. Don't take it. That stuff is, I'm not sure what step you're breaking if you take this stuff, but that this stuff down here is for you. That's for you to take. Okay, so we know most of you have a big book. These are the best sources for a big book, great for the steps, but it didn't cover the traditions. It has them listed in the back as well as the concepts. The 12 and 12, now you've got the traditions added to it. Came out 15 years after the steps. Then the AA service manual has some of Bill's most eloquent writing. And when he talks about especially the more spiritual of the concepts. So these are the best direct sources for the things that we're getting ready to talk about. But we have a couple of things that are kind of like the Idiot's Guide to, except that because we don't take criticism very well, it doesn't say the Idiot's Guide to. But it's called The 12 Traditions Illustrated and The 12 Concepts Illustrated. So if this is a little bit too much for you to get through, you can read this first, and at least it'll make you a little bit familiar with it. And these have, in addition to it, and I think you can download this from the website, they change things now and then, but they have a concepts checklist and a traditions checklist that you can download, and if not, they've got them at Intergroup for a nickel or whatever it is. But the traditions checklist is great. When you practice these principles in All Our Affair, you can just change the word group for family, for workplace, for softball team, for tennis team, for rock and roll band, whatever it is. But it asks questions on here which I have never been able to successfully answer all the right way. Like tradition one, our common welfare should come first, personal recovery depends upon AA unity. It has 10 questions behind each one of these. One of them says, am I in my group a healing, mending, integrating person, or am I divisive? What about gossip and taking other members' inventories? I've never seen gossip like we have in the program now, and so much misinformation passed along like we do now. When I got sober, well, 38 years ago, and we're now coming up on 80 years as a fellowship, so I was a little bit less than, I'm a little bit less than halfway. But still, there were a lot of old-timers. My sponsor got sober in the 50s. His sponsor got sober in 1943. And his sponsor was Dr. Bob. So I was only two away from Dr. Bob, and we were hearing things. The traditions came out because AA was getting ready to fail. So these principles were put into place so that we would not fail. And that's the first reason to learn the traditions, is if you don't practice in your group, your group's probably going to get off base, and at some point it may close down, or worse yet, it will influence a lot of people to act and behave in a very self-centered manner, and that means that you will hurt somebody that comes to that meeting because they may be looking for unconditional love, and instead they come to a very judgmental group that's passing out bad information, and you may kill somebody because they say, I don't want to be part of this. You know, I haven't had a drink since my first day, nor have I had a desire for a drink since my first day in all those years. But I had two tours in Vietnam, and on one of those I had a cousin that was over in Vietnam at the same time. He came back, and I tried to just share with him that it was working for me, and he was an alcoholic. And he went to some meetings. I'm from Louisville, Kentucky, and he went to some meetings where he was working on the other side of the river in Indiana. And I found out later they were just terrible meetings. They were the kind of meeting where somebody'd sit down, they'd talk about a problem, then everybody else would tell them how to fix that problem. You know, they weren't lawyers, they weren't mechanics, they weren't even, but they would tell them how to fix that problem. And it's not just up there. I remember being at a meeting at in Gainesville, and we were going to something else up there, but just decided to go into a meeting, a friend of mine and I, and a guy was brand new. He had just moved to town, and he was talking about the fact that the people at work, he wasn't getting along very well with them. Then he just kind of happened to drop that he hadn't been to a meeting in 9 months. And so that's the kind of thing where somebody might share, well, you know, I get along better with people when I go to meetings. That's a starting point, et cetera. Anyway, instead of that, out of two, three guys over here says, well, you know, part of it here is that, you know, you're a Yankee, and a lot of people don't like Yankees. And that was the, Now, would I have gone back to that meeting again? I went to a meeting in Virginia where the first four people who shared had less than a month and were still doing drugs, and each one of them talked about 15 minutes. And afterwards, some guy said, well, I hope you come back to our meeting. I said, why would I possibly come back to this meeting? And he didn't get it, and I walked off. I mean, my best friend was a guy named Keith Lewis. If you get a chance, listen to him. But Keith and I used to bitch and whine about these meetings we would go to like that out on the road. And as I mentioned, AAs don't take criticism very well. So we're not going to go in there and tell them how to straighten up their meeting. What he and I decided was, he had more time than me. And we're both smart guys. And it took us about a year to figure out we just wouldn't support the meetings that weren't good and solution-based, and we would support those who were. That's the only vote I've got, is where I put my support. And then we could stop griping about this, because he and I were really getting negative about, you know, what the hell happened to AA type stuff, you know, the bleeding deacon stuff that happens. And after we determined this, I stopped sending anybody to or supporting a group. If somebody asked me about that group, I wouldn't badmouth them. I said, well, I wouldn't go to it. And they said, why? I said, I just wouldn't. And that's all I would say. I wouldn't get into personalities or anything else. Anyway, this traditions checklist is great. Tradition two. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Question. Do I criticize or do I trust and support my group officers, AA committees, and office workers, newcomers, old-timers? In group discussions, do I sound off about those matters in which I have no experience and little knowledge? Yes. Do I have to save face in group discussion, or can I yield in good spirit to the group conscience and work cheerfully along with it? So all these stuff, at any given time, I have had the wrong answer to all of these on these checklists. But the checklists are a great way to study them. The short, the illustrated is great, and you got them for the concepts and for the traditions. And even though you may never end up going to, there are all kinds of service work. If you make coffee at a group, that's service work. If you talk to the newcomer, that's service work. If you put the donuts out, that's service work. But then you can also be part of intergroup, that's service work. You can also be on a committee for the Atlanta Roundup or any kind of thing. And Atlanta Roundup's not an official anything. We don't have official roundups. That's just some AAs and Al-Nons that get together and do that. So, but that's service work because it carries the message. Then there's what we call the official structure of AA, where you can be a GSR, that's Group Service Representative, when you go to Macon, where then you can become a DCM, and or you can become a treasurer, or a grapevine committee, whatever, all kinds of jobs. And then the delegate is the person that is like your area representative that goes to New York, and there are 93 areas in North America, and you go up there and we discuss AA concerns worldwide and talk about what's going on in the United States. When Facebook started taking off and everybody started breaking their anonymity on Facebook, we discussed that and almost unanimously agreed that Facebook is a matter, it's press. Unless you have unless your Facebook page is set so that nobody but AA members can say it, if you go on there and say so-and-so knocked out of the park at the so-and-so group last night, or I just had my 31st birthday, you're breaking the traditions. And you're going to hurt people eventually. And the reason for that is we're based in humility, number one. Two, if you fail and somebody has seen you on there, because I saw one the other day of somebody that, you know, how I don't know how they get these. They get people that you go online and they have about 20 people, some of them you don't know, that it tells you what they're doing. They're over Arby's getting a roast beef sandwich or whatever it is and stuff. And one of them was talking about how the group just, you know, stank and everything, and the people's attitudes were so bad that he had to go take a drink. So, you know, if somebody doesn't know anything about AA and they read this stuff, that's the problem. And a lot of there's a movement out right now that says it's called Faces of Recovery, where people go out and they say, I'm going to help people get over the stigma of being an alcoholic by being a celebrity and coming out and telling you. The only thing that does is an ego boost to the guy who does it. It shows he doesn't have any humility. And the last time they did that, shortly after I came in, there was 100 celebrities from Hollywood, and out of those, about 90 of them all got drunk. Humility means I don't get any credit for anything. I don't get publicly recognized for it. We do too much public recognition for people in AA. I mean, I speak a lot, Barbara speaks a lot, Michael speaks a lot, and people get treated. We don't have any. The only reason we're doing this is because we got a lot of time and experience, and we may be able to be more articulate than some people. I'm a writer, so I should be able to use words. But that's not because we're a better member than the guy who does nothing but open up every week and help people come in the door and greet people. One job's not better than another. So there's nobody that should be put on a pedestal, and our traditions allow that. So here's the deal. Cell phones, besides what they do on a practical basis, have been a new tool in me working with people in AA. I'm a smart guy. I made good enough grades on my SATs as a ninth grader to get into Harvard, Yale, Princeton, any place. I came close to acing them. I was in a gifted program, advanced program, and I got put in that program. My parents sacrificed to move us to a new neighborhood so I could go into this program. The same year they did that was the year I started drinking. So I didn't really get the benefit of the advanced program. But this is a smartphone. Now, as a smart guy, I've got a lot of information that's inside me. It's been programmed. It's been put in there. Some of it's right, some of it's wrong, but I got a lot of information in there. This has a lot of information that's been programmed into it. But without connecting this to a higher power, it will not tell you what the weather is. It will not tell you the score of the University of Kentucky ball game, which I went to, and I don't even want to get into that. It will not. It will not give you a map to go from here to Marietta, because it's not connected to a higher power. It's not connected to a power that you can't see or touch. You have to connect this phone, and the way you connect it is through a contract. In AA, we call that a third step. First two steps tell me that I'm so messed up that it's not going to work doing it my way. The third step's where I take a contract out with God. And it's a one-sided contract. I say, God, I'll do whatever you ask, and in return, you'll take away all my problems, you'll supply whatever I need, et cetera, et cetera. And I give you complete control. I turn my life over to you. Now, we don't normally do that very completely, but that's the step that we take when we come in, you know. And when I am connected, it's called conscious contact. The only thing I know about God, this higher power, and I did graduate work in intercultural studies where I studied the dharmas of the Buddhas, the Hinduism, Confucianism, all the Eastern religions, all the Western religions, and so forth. A lot of what I write has some comedy in it, and this was in the 60s, and we were told that we should give a synopsis of the difference between Eastern religions and Western religions in 2 minutes. So I got up and said, the West says, do, do, do. The East says, be, be, be. But Sinatra says, doobie, doobie. Obviously, I was drinking during the course. I didn't get everything I was supposed to get out of it. But that is kind of true. The only difference in the way you interpret things is the West, we do say it's based on action. And then a lot of the Eastern things are just be and be still and stuff like that. Those are just home groups. They're just home groups. And some home groups do things a little bit differently than other home groups. But you have to be connected. All of them agree you have to be connected. And if I was to tell you about God, I would tell you about two or three things that happened to me. And one of them, you know, we're covering this. One of the biggest things that keeps us from accepting God's love and being part of God's family and being part of AA is a lack of forgiveness. We're still angry or hold a resentment towards somebody. Somebody abused me. Somebody stole from me. somebody continually told me that I was no good, and you know, we have all this anger built up in there. And when I did my amends on my fourth house cleaning, my first four, I only had one resentment, and that was towards a girl that I don't know what her name was, but apparently I didn't like her. And because I had brain damage, it took me about a year or so to be able to read when I came in here. After my brain started clicking in, I did resentments, and everybody that I knew, I resented. I resented the women who didn't respond to me the way I wanted them to. I responded the guys who were bad boys, and why did the girl go with the bad guy? He was treating her badly, or guys that were better looking, or guys that had more money, or whatever, and stuff. And I really didn't, I also think I resent God. The truth is, the bottom line of my problem was that I resented God. I had tried to turn my life over to God after seeing The Ten Commandments, a film that came out when I was a kid, and we saw it, and there up on the screen was this enormous amount of power. And the next day I went down the aisle at Linden Baptist Church, and I surrendered all. And I didn't take any steps. I was like the newcomer who comes to you. You don't take any steps to change. You can come to all the meetings you want. You're not going to change until you take steps to change. And so I didn't do that. And at Vacation Bible School at that time, we didn't have any sponsors, so nobody told me I was supposed to do that. So I didn't get better. And I thought that the reason I didn't get better was because God didn't care for me. There was this expression that we are the chosen ones. So if somebody's chosen, somebody's not chosen. If you've ever been the last guy standing, they don't pick you to play on either baseball team, you know, in a pickup game or basketball or whatever, you know, you feel rejected. You feel not as good. And I just felt I had this anger. And I had anger towards God, and it built and it built and it built and it built. And I was in AA asking God to keep me sober every morning and thanking God at night. But I didn't trust God. I had no real relationship with God. It was up here. And on that fourth house cleaning, which I caught was my big, I do an annual house cleaning. And the guys that I got sober with do it, and the guys I sponsor do it. Because if you don't keep growing, you'll just go, you start going backwards again. But the last amend that I made on that particular round was to go into a church that I had been a member of when I was in high school. I had hated it so much that I had defaced the property, I'd stolen stuff, I'd torn up things, I'd bad-mouthed them. And when I went into this chapel to find somebody, there was nobody there. I walked all over the whole church building. Nobody was there. It was open, but nobody was there. And I finally realized who I was there for, and I got down on my knees, and I forgave God. Now, that may sound like an arrogant statement, but if you come in and you are, if there's anything between you and God, and I don't know any alcoholic who comes to AA who doesn't have something between them and God. Even if they're atheists, they have something between them and God, because they just don't believe, or they're angry. And when I did that, one of the most profound spiritual experiences I've ever had took place. I felt like I weighed nothing. The what Sandy talked about, drop the rock. I just felt like I was free. And something happened inside of me, and it happened the same way that Sandy described it there. I felt like I was a spiritual being having a human experience rather than a human being having a spiritual experience. That my body was a shell that I was using for a while, but that my soul was me. That's who I am. I'm one of God's children. It gave me a different perspective. I had, like all young guys, I got sober when I was 27, and after I'd been sober for a little while, you know, you want to, and this was in the 70s, you know, and it was still, you know, the sexually free movement was still going on, and so I wanted to sleep with people. And what I ended up finding out was that if I'm looking at a woman sexually without really loving her, I am disrespecting her father. When I was in high school and college, if I took out a girl and I knew her the father, I would make certain I got her home on time and all that, because I respected their father and may have had some fear of the father. But here I am. Any woman that I know is one of God's daughters. And how can I ask God to take care of me, to provide what I need, to love me, to keep me sober, if I'm disrespecting his daughters? I'd like to say that that made me, you know, a virgin or something, but it didn't. But it did change things. It's like the ending of the ruination of your drinking when you no longer think that that drinking is really going to help. Just hopping in sack with somebody as an escape thing is not going to help. When it's a matter of love, it's a beautiful thing. So I'm not trying to get into anybody's, you know, I'm just telling you this is my experience. Your experience may be totally different, but that changed my life. And I can't, you know, so now I try to stay connected to God, and I try to have this conscious contact. But here's what I can't do. I'm a combat veteran. Because I'm a combat veteran, I can't even hear what I'm saying. I wear hearing aids, and I have very bad tinnitus. Everybody who's around a lot of explosions and even small arms fire, you lose your hearing. All vets do. But I also have bad tinnitus. And I was exposed to Agent Orange, and because of that, I had something that happened where I ended up with peritonitis, which normally kills people. Didn't kill me, but the antibiotics they used to save my life gave me vertigo. I can't close my eyes without, if I'm walking here and close my eyes, in a minute I'll be over there. I have no gyroscope. So if I close my eyes in silence, like people talk about for meditation, I fall over and I hear a loud ringing in my ears. So I can't meditate. But here's the thing. Just the same way you connect to God is your business. How I connect to God is my business. So I'm just sharing what I do. When I'm paying attention on a good day, 100 times a day, I will say, before I pick up the phone, before I have a meeting, before I read, before I listen to someone, I say, God, help me to hear what this person needs, and help me to take the gifts that you've given me to be useful to that person. Now, I'm going to have a meeting with somebody, and we're trying to get them to invest $2 million in a film project. In the old days, I did everything I could to manipulate them into giving me that $2 million. But in God's way, I go into the meeting, and I may find out that this guy has a sister who needs help to get into AA. And my job is to help her. If I'm helping my brothers and my sisters, God will provide everything I need. He says it over and over and over and over that he'll provide. When we take the third step, he provides what we needed. So if I am loving you, and I mean in the way God wants me to love you, then God will take care of me. And if you read Chuck Chamberlain's book, that's the whole thing he says. All we do is take care of our brothers. That's our business. And taking care of us is God's business. You know, I've had people, the only way not to get people to dislike you occasionally or gossip about you is never do anything. But everybody who does anything, whether you're the group chair or you speak or your delegate or whatever it is, you will get some people that form an opinion of you and they don't like you. That's not my business. That's their opinion. When I was standing for delegate, I had somebody who tried to smear my reputation and did a tremendous concerted effort with pages written out that people could take to groups. Weird. And so my sponsor said, stay above the fray, don't get into it, don't even respond. So that's what I did, and I was the first person to get elected on the first ballot as delegate in about 25 years, and I got elected. I got I think it's 85% of the vote, you have to have 2/3 on the first ballot, and where I got several hundred, the closest to me was 10, and there were 8 people standing. Because you, the fellowship, responded. I didn't need to tell you that I was not guilty of what they were saying. You responded in your hearts. You knew that that was a ploy by somebody. And it taught me a lesson. If I trust God, I don't have to go around straightening out you about my reputation. You know, we get our feelings hurt. All right, so without us, you got to go through the steps, and for that, get a sponsor and go through the steps. I'm not going to cover that. But if you do that, you will come to a point where now you are sober and you are no longer the problem all the time, but you still don't know how to deal with other people. There's nothing in the big book that tells you how to be a father, how to have a relationship with your wife, how to be an employer, how to be an employer. And things have changed again, a different era that that we're in. the public opinion back then was that we should all be good people, that you did, it was, you didn't want to have a divorce. This is in the 30s. It was a scandal if you got a divorce. It was a scandal if you were having an affair. It was a scandal if you stole something. If you broke any of the Ten Commandments or the Eightfold Path of Truth by the Buddha, whatever it was, if you broke any of those, it was a scandal. So there was a public expectation, and that public expectation was that, that you would behave in an honorable way and you would be honest. We don't have that anymore. Our role models are people that get that way by sleeping with a bunch of people or by being a model and having a porn film out for them. I mean, it's just gone nuts. It's not anything like when I was a kid. It just, it is. I don't know what, so today we actually have to have a higher level of standards in AA than the public does, because we'll get drunk if we act like most of those people, and most of those people are drunk. So, but given all that, we have our spiritual awakening, and here is what we come upon, the traditions. We think about them in the group. I had learned to love unconditionally another person for the first time in my life, because when I got sober, somebody let me stay in their basement. I was homeless when I got here. Somebody let me stay in their basement in a cot, and this was in Louisville. I went back to Louisville. It was my hometown. And they would pick up somebody new, do a 12-step call. They'd bring them to this guy's house, and I would stay up with them at night while they were getting sick and help them dry out and all the stuff. We had a doctor that might give them a shot. But that was my job. And I loved these guys, many of whom were not grateful. Many of, you know, some of us are grateful from the very beginning, but most of us aren't. Many of whom were kind of a bad case, and many of whom would just walk right, as soon as they got to feeling better, would walk right back out and start drinking again. But that was not my problem. I could love them unconditionally because I could see in him what I went through. And I had sympathy for that guy, and I had empathy for that person. Now, my experience with God was different. It's what I just told you. It's where I had to forgive God. And then I started seeing God every place because I had a conscious contact. Before, I blocked God out. So now, because of the steps, I've got a relationship with God and I've got a relationship with human beings. Before that, I didn't like either one. I'm going to go through the traditions, and I'm going to talk about a little bit with the group, but I'm going to talk about how we use them personally, because if there's not anything in this for us, we alcoholics, the way this is written, the great thing about AA is it's written because it knows how self-centered we all are. So we have to see something in it, but we always get something out of doing something for other people. You know, you have to give it away to keep it, all those kind of things. The first tradition, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. That's true. That's why if one person in a group is just really having, you know, creating all kinds of problems, you know, then the group, for the sake of the group, if that person has a real behavior problem, can ask that person not to come. Everybody has the right to be an AA member, but they don't have to be a right of my AA group if they come in here screaming and yelling and stuff. When I was young, the old timers would take that person out every meeting they come to, and they'd say, we want you to help stay sober, but you can't do it if you're going to help the people in there get drunk. I mean, it's a privilege to come to AA. We don't get to be a jerk our whole life. That's not a right. But what does this mean, first tradition? Unity is we before me. We know how it works in the group, but how does it work in our personal life? Barbara and I are married 31 years. Well, we'll be married 31 years in a few months. And before I got married to Barbara, I had been engaged 6 times, but nobody had ever married me. I had lived with a couple of those girls, but nobody had ever married me. So I could never even get anybody to actually fulfill the commitment. The closest I came was a girl that looked like Olivia Newton-John back in 1973, and 3 weeks before the wedding, I missed 2 days. I was a daily drinker, even in high school, but now and then I would go on a binge on top of the daily drinking. I don't know. But anyway, I went on a binge and lost 2 days. I wasn't a big blackout guy, because if you drink daily all the time, you kind of gray all the time, but not blackout. So we didn't get married. But Barbara and I have been married for 31 years. Now, how do I go from a person who nobody will marry to somebody who can stay married to somebody else for 31 years? We before me. That means that we have discussions, because there may be something I'm doing that doesn't work for her. And if I've got a good reason, we talk about it. Maybe there's one reason. But if I'm just doing something out of habit, you know, like putting the toilet seat up, then I can change that. I can give a little bit. And if I have to have everything my way, if I have to be right, I won't be married for 31 years. So we come before me is very important. It means I'm giving up some of my rights. When, for those who've been around for a while, you know Tom Iverson. Tom Iverson's got 57 years. He's not speaking anymore because he's having some memory problems. But Tom is a wonderful guy, and he practices these principles. My best friend was Keith Lewis. Keith had been sponsored by Tom at one time and by Sandy at another time. And so I called Tom first to see when he could get together for the memorial. In AA, a lot of times when we have a speaker like Keith, you wait a couple months and then everybody flies in for a memorial to honor that person. And Tom gave me the date that he could meet. So I'm planning on us meeting on that day. I call everybody else. It's all organized. I called Tom back and said, great, we're doing it on the date you said. He said, oh, you know what? Darn. I said, you know, I've got a tumor up here in my brain, and they're going to try to remove that on Monday, and I've got to go in on Saturday to be prepped. I said, well, obviously that's kind of important, so tell me when you can change it to, and we'll do it another time. He called me back half an hour later. He said, I got them to move my brain surgery back 2 days so that we could honor Keith. And that's why people have been following Tom Iverson around for 57 years. If you've heard his story, he's the guy that killed two people when he was 24 and drunk driving. Went to prison, was never supposed to drive again. Instead, not only did he drive, but he ended up being a counselor, then a correction officer, and he became the warden in a prison system where he had been once committed. You don't hear those kind of stories outside of AA. It's a miracle. Why would I be willing to give up my personal needs, we before me? Because of the second tradition. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. I can give up part of me because if I do that, God promises he's going to take care of me. He's going to take care of us. That's the only reason I would do it. If it was just me and another person, we'd be fighting all the time about who was going to get their way. But what we're doing by surrendering is turning it over to the one who has all power. And that I talked about earlier. There's only one power, and we're not it. It says that in every piece of literature I've ever read, unless you're a Satan worshiper or something, that I've ever read. Well, even there it says you're giving the power to somebody. But that's the only reason that we do that. When Barbara and I can't agree about something, and really can't agree, then instead of taking an action, we will pray and turn it over to God. And never have we done that where God didn't provide an answer. And sometimes it was just a wait. But the answer was always provided. The third tradition, the only requirement for AA membership is desire to stop drinking. They had a group here. A friend of mine went to a group, had a problem with sex addiction, and went to a group, and they voted and blackballed him so he couldn't go to that meeting. And the reason they did it was because one of the people in there had the same group of friends and thought this guy might talk about him, so he did it selfishly and blackballed. All it was take was one vote. How would I get unconditional love and believe in a God in a group where he could be blackballed? You know? I was a Sigma Chi at the University of Kentucky, and you know, that was a fraternity. You know, it's not supposed to have an honorable thing. It was mostly parties. But anyway, but there, I understand you blackball. You get just a group. It's like a little group you run around with. You're on a baseball team. You can cut people and pick the people you want to play it. But as far as AA or God's family, I can't just pick somebody. So it's acceptance without judgment. And if I don't do that, I cut myself short in a lot of different ways. I cut myself off from people. As I told you, Keith was my best friend, and Keith was this wonderful guy. And we were both speaking out in Prescott, Arizona, and I said, look, and I had just come out of an operation that I had where I had esophageal cancer, and I was supposed to be dead. So as a celebration of life, this is the first time I spoke after that. I said, let's drive out and let's go through the Grand Canyon and let's go through Santa Fe and let's go to the Cowboy Hall of Fame and Museum in Oklahoma City. I love road trips. So I had all this stuff set up. And Keith whom I did not know at the time, had Lou Gehrig's disease, would be dead within a few months, and was starting to frontal lobe dementia as part of Lou Gehrig's disease. But he wasn't having any of the feet or hand problems you normally have with that. So we didn't know that he was sick, but he just was acting strange. And he said, I don't have time for that. We planned it. Then I called him up, real happy, but I don't have time for that. You know, that's just, I got AA business to do, and da-da-da. And I thought, what the hell is he talking about? So I got very angry, and I wrote 2 pages of notes for a phone conversation I was going to have with Keith because I was concerned. He was irritable, discontent, depressed, seemed angry at me, angry at a lot of things and people in the world. When we talked about the trip, let me know there would only be one way to do it. Go to whatever you had planned at your pace and I could go along. No discussion, no flexibility, even about speaking. You know, very rigid right now, you know. And I go, and then, you know, what? And then what can I or any of us do about this? Anyway, basically, I'm just ticked off at him, so I'm going to give him, you know, hell about that. But what I have learned in AA is that we don't have to act right away. That if you feel like you want to write a letter to the airline you're on when you're sitting on it for 3 hours, like I did after sitting 4 hours on a flight coming from Kennedy back to Atlanta when I had a hot date on that weekend. This is well before Barbara and I were married. And I wrote this zipping letter to Frank Borman, and then the stewardess pointed out that, and they were stewardess back then, that I was on Delta and Frank Borman was the president of Eastern. But anyway, we were getting free cocktails for those 4 hours. Anyway, so I waited a day or two, and I thought, you know, my friend Keith doesn't act like this. This is not Keith. There is something wrong with Keith, and something that I need to get, and I do not need to criticize him right now. He needs my love more than that. If somebody's really angry and lashing out or they're acting peculiar, they generally need love more than they need somebody to criticize them. Nobody ever said to me, shut up and get in the car. I had brain damage in the beginning, and they would tolerate me rambling sometimes. They loved me. And they told me they loved me every day. And if I had done that letter, I would have missed the most joyful hour of my life. When Keith died, I was in the room with him. His wife was there. Sandy Beach and Tom Ivester both left the room at 11:30. He was in a hospice. His wife asked me to stay. I was holding his hand in one hand, holding a crucifix. He was Catholic, a crucifix in the other. He knew he was going to see God. His wife got in bed next to him and just lay her head next to his. And for an hour, the spirit came into that room that took him home. And I have never felt such joy in my entire life. So today, I am looking forward to the time when I go. I don't know when it'll be. I've had 2 tours in Vietnam, a helicopter crash, motorcycle accident, street drunk, esophageal cancer, which is 98% fatal, peritonitis, which is almost always fatal, got diabetes now, and somehow God keeps saving my life, and the only reason for that is not because I'm a good guy, but because I've got more work to do. When my time is over, because Keith had done his work, God took him home. We didn't see anything. It was just like being in this bubble of joy. And when the moment that he took his last breath, his wife gave me a high five. We were giggling with joy. And then it went away and we had grief. But I would have missed that moment, which gave me more insight to where I'm going. The big book says we will lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. I can't just take it halfway. It says the hereafter. And I would have missed that moment had I been critical. The fourth tradition is each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. If you as a group break the traditions, like you talk about all kinds of things that have nothing to do with AA, like they did my cousin, you can kill somebody who has alcoholism. And that affects AA as a whole. The only thing that can happen to a group usually is that when groups start doing that, somebody will delist it so that it's not listed as an AA meeting anymore. We had a group here that was combining, and we mixed the clubs with the groups, that was mixing the group's business with the club's business. And they found out about an intergroup, and they took it off the list so that nobody knew about it unless you already knew about it. Because a club is no more part of AA than the Episcopal Church is. It's just a place where the group meets. And we mix all kinds of things up there. There are groups that give all their money to a clubhouse. That's like giving all your money to the Episcopal Church, and what they don't have, what they have left over, they give back to you so you can give to AA. So when you donate at a group that meets at certain clubs, and there are about five of them around town that do this, you're donating to a building. You're not donating to AA. And a lot of our people don't know that. I've got guys that are my grand pigeons that got 25 years that do that. I can share with them, but, you know, I don't go around whipping people and saying. But independence, this, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups as a whole. About 12 years ago, I did a film, 15 years ago, I did a film about AA called House Full of Miracles. And I was up in Akron, we were shooting this film, and we were shooting it in around Akron and at Dr. Bob's home. And as I was going out and researching, setting up locations and stuff, I would say, we're doing this for AA, and we're going to introduce it at Founders Day this year. And I expected them to fully say, oh, you know, AA is such a wonderful, it's just, it helps so many people, the people are just, it's delightful. I am grateful for AA. Instead, I got, you know, we normally leave town when they come because all the motorcycle groups come in, they raise hell and make noise all night and trash the place. That's true. A lot of bikers are defiant. The opposite of defiance is humility. If you're seeking humility, then you don't get to say, don't tell me what to do. Now, I have no feeling on the right front leg for my Triumph 650, went into a Ford Galaxy when it pulled in front of me, so I like motorcycles. But I don't applaud defiance, even though I used to date the sister of a, well, date's kind of an overused word, met for recreational purposes, the sister of the head of the Gypsy Outlaws chapter in Louisville, so they would come over and party at my house, and the next day I'd get up and put a tie on and go to an advertising agency. Anyway, independence has its limits. So anything I do, you know, if I've got Honk If You Love Bill W. or Easy Does It, and I give somebody the finger after they cut me off in traffic, then I'm not serving AA very well. But that's the same thing with my family or my friends. I dishonor them by acting in a way that's not loving or giving or serving. Independence has its limits. Yes, I got the right to do certain things, but if I do, I pay a price. And I make others pay a price for my selfish actions. Fifth tradition. Each Alcoholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity having but one primary purpose, that of carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. So that's all we're really there for. We're not there to offer legal advice, medical advice, anything else, those kind of things, or tell Yankees that that's why they're having problems with their employees in Gainesville. But the principle behind this, that as simple as possible for me, is what is my purpose? What is our purpose? If I don't have a purpose in anything, then I won't achieve it. If I join something and I don't have a purpose for it, then I won't achieve it. And what is my purpose? You know, I get the guys that I sponsor, we write down what their purpose here on earth is, and we write down their jobs. Father, son, brother, employee. In my case, I'm a Vietnam vet. I can help vets. I'm a cancer survivor. I can help others who have cancer. I write down all these things, and then I can use the gifts that I've been given or the experience that I have to be useful to somebody else. That's my purpose. But I used to sit around thinking of my material or of the flesh objective. If I want this girl, I need to get that car, whatever. And everything was about getting something to make me temporarily feel good. So what is my purpose? If I don't have a purpose, if you don't have a purpose in what you're doing in the group or whatever, you'll forget it. And this is easy enough to forget. In the 30s in this country, railroads carried 85% of all people, livestock, and goods around the country. 85%. But they forgot what their purpose was. Their purpose was to transport people, livestock, and goods. And if they had remembered their purpose, they would have been like FedEx or UPS, where they use some trains, some planes, some trucks, some boats. But instead, they just built tracks and put trains on them. And they almost went out of business, and would have, except for the United States bailing them out back in the 60s. Their purpose was to transport, not to build railroads. And so sometimes what we think is our purpose, because we get stuck in the trappings, is not really our purpose. So the best way to find out what your purpose is, do a list of what you are. An AA member, a husband, a writer, a brother, a son, an uncle, a friend, sponsor, tennis player, cancer survivor, combat veteran, neighbor, citizen of my community, et cetera, et cetera. That gives me a way to do it. And then I can do that budget I was talking about where I, how many hours a week or how many hours a month does it take for me to do that job? And if I end up needing 40 hours a day, obviously I got to cut something out or change some things. The sixth tradition, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. What this tells me is I have more than enough to do without minding other people's business. I do the very best I can to get back a relationship with my father and my mother. I had knocked my father down. My father was a colonel. My little sister's a colonel. Everybody in our family's military. And so I had dishonored him because when I came back from Vietnam, I ran through all the booze in his house. So I'm going out drunk to get in the car, which was his car, and to go up to the liquor store. And he tried to stop me. And I knocked him down while my family watched all this on the... They were on the landing on the steps, and I knocked my dad down going out the door so I can get some more booze. That's the way I was when I was drinking. So I go back and I make amends. I make amends by calling them every week, by sending birthday cards, by doing all the thoughtful things you're supposed to do. But then I would go back and visit, and the next thing that happens when I visit is my dad and I differed in political opinions, and he'd start something about who was running for office, and we'd get in an argument. And each time we'd go, I'd ruin the trip because I'd get into a thing. When is the last time you won an argument with somebody about politics? When is the last time you won an argument about abortion? When's the last time you won an argument with somebody about immigration? All those things that we have opinions about and that we can vote for and there's a process for, you're not going to change somebody's mind. If they know what they think, they know what they think. But what I did do was waste a lot of time. It was like Keith and I spending all our time whining about these bad groups. I waste a lot of time if I'm trying to give somebody my opinion. And unless somebody asks for my opinion, like the little emails where they say they're going to give you something and they don't really give you something, but unless somebody asks for my opinion, then I don't really need to give my opinion about anything. You know, not necessary. If I speak at the AA group for 2 minutes on somebody's made a motion and I say, in my experience, this, 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 and this, then I'm doing something useful because it's part of the process. But in that case, the group has asked for me to, it asks all of us to share our experience. There was a guy at the, oh, I'm about running out of time. Seventh tradition. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. The thing with this is freedom from bondage. If you owe somebody, it decides what you can and cannot do. Not you. The only way to be free to go do God's will is not owe anybody anything and not have any encumberment, a lot of stuff. Owning your car. You can make payments on a house, but a house that you can get out of easy. Whatever. If you got a lot of debt, it's going to tell you how to run your life, and it's usually not going to be in a way that gives you the freedom to go do what God wants you to do. You're in bondage. So if I have some money, and I think, well, I'm going to go get a brand new Shelby GT350 because I can afford the payments. The money that I put into that Shelby GT350 may prevent me from actually doing what God wants me to do, and the only way God blesses me is if I do God's will. So if I get too materialistic about things, if you're rich and you can afford it, fine. But if you're financing something to get a luxury car, or you're financing something to get a house that's much bigger than you need, you're basically saying, I'm putting God on the back burner because me having that car or that house or whatever it is, or that Rolex, is more important than... And Barbara and I live extremely, extremely... modestly right now. At one point we lived in a big house in Buckhead that was worth more than $1 million. We had I had about 3 or 4 cars, and I had a 65 Mustang that was a show car, and we had all this stuff. And then I got sick and I couldn't make those payments. That house, the down payment on that house was $300,000. And that payment was $6,000 a month. For $300,000 I could have bought the house and taking the $6,000 a month I paid later and put it into some investments so that we wouldn't be broke now, because we lost all our retirement money, and we're paying the price for getting stuff rather than getting the freedom to do what God wants us to do. And I'm not saying you have to